Clive Hamilton is Professor of Public Ethics at CAPPE, as you pronounce that CAPE or CAP?
CAP.
And holds the Vice Chancellor's Chair at Charles Sturt University, as I said. He was also founder and for 14 years the Executive Director of the Australia Institute, which is a public interest think tank. He has been a visiting academic at a number of universities and has been one of the pioneers in the field of writing about this new geological epoch called the Anthropocene, but before that was also writing for a popular audience on climate change and climate risk. So it's my pleasure to welcome Clive.
Thanks very much, Tom, for that introduction, and to the Oxford Centre for the Environment and the Centre for Tropical Forests for the invitation, and thanks, folks, for coming along. Okay, so this is really, these are some themes which are in a manuscript of a new book that I'm just finishing off that will be published by Polity Press next May. Okay, well, as you know, the geological timescale divides the Earth's 4.5 billion year history into eons, eras, periods, epochs and ages in descending order of significance. And the scale is familiar to the public in terms like the Jurassic, Cretaceous and Pleistocene. So profound has been the influence of humans on the Earth that geoscientists have recently proposed that the planet has entered a new geological epoch, the Anthropocene, the Age of Humans. Defined by the fact, and this is the kind of canonical statement that I quote often, the human from Stefan et al. The human imprint on the global environment has now become, the human imprint on the global environment has now become so large and active that it rivals some of the great forces of nature in its impact on the functioning of the Earth system. It's important to stress that the idea of the Anthropocene was invented not as another term to describe the extent of human impact across the landscape, the environment, or ecosystems, but to capture a very recent rupture in the nature, in the Earth system and its functioning. So it's a change in the nature of the human impact that the Anthropocene is designed to capture, activity on a scale sufficient to shift the geological evolution of the planet. And that's the meaning of this canonical statement. The human imprint on the global environment has now become so large and active that it rivals some of the great forces of nature in its impact on the functioning of the Earth system. So the advent of the Anthropocene marks the end of the Holocene, a 10,000-year epoch of remarkable climatic stability and clemency. But the Holocene was preceded by hundreds of thousands of years of climatic chaos. For almost all of Homo sapiens' 200,000 years existence, the Earth's climate has been a jagged history of ice ages, little ice ages, and warming periods, with massive ice sheets at times covering most of the northern hemisphere, then retreating for short periods of a few thousand years before returning to drive human populations to a precarious existence in the cold or to epic migrations towards the equator. Although humans survived these wild swings, at times populations were decimated. But some 10,000 years ago, the climate stabilised around an average temperature very close to the modern one prior to the influence of industrialisation. The Holocene's mild and unusually stable climate permitted human civilization to flourish. Settled agriculture, impossible in the climatic gyrations of previous times, emerged. Some 7,000 years ago, in the so-called cradle of civilization, that is the river valleys that drain into the Persian Gulf, the new conditions permitted not only settled communities, but that is based on irrigated agriculture due to the regularity of the seasons, which was new to the Holocene. It also permitted the development of the wheel, writing, mathematics, legal codes, centralised government and social strata. In the Holocene, humans were able to free themselves from the dictates of nature and to flourish on the earth. Now we're told that the halcyon millennia of the Holocene have come to an end. Humans have flourished so successfully in the sympathetic environment of the last 10,000 years that we have, in very recent times, shifted Earth's geological arc. In particular, the effects of human activity on the climate system, this shows the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere and the extraordinary increase in the last, particularly 60 or 70 years. The impact of humans on the climate system, warming, melting ice masses, acidification of the oceans and rising seas, these are expected to last thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands of years. When the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere last year touched on 400 parts per million, it had not breached that threshold for 23 million years. Once again, the forces of nature, now in fact a hybrid of natural forces under human influence, will probably begin to drive wild swings in the climate. Certainly if it gets away from us, as it seems likely to do, although perhaps not. Human disturbance of the climate system is now detectable from the beginning of large-scale coal burning at the onset of the Industrial Revolution or at the end of the 18th century. The rise in atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide was gradual for the next 150 years, but became very steep after the Second World War, as this famous chart from Mauna Loa shows. Now a range of indicators shows sharp and unambiguous impact on the Earth system from the end of the Second World War. The post-war period stands out, writes Earth scientist Will Steffen, as one of the most remarkable in all of human history for its rapidity and pervasiveness of change. Other Earth scientists express it a little differently. So this is from the IGBP website. The last 60 years have without doubt seen the most profound transformation of the human relationship with the natural world in the history of humankind. A glance at charts on resource use and waste volumes shows immediately why the period after the Second World War has been dubbed the Great Acceleration.
You don't really need to see all of these, but the dotted line is from 1950. You've got CO2 acceleration, nitrous oxide, methane, ocean acidification, biosphere degradation, fish capture, stratospheric ozone, and so on.
And so that's why expert opinion now dates the beginning of the new epoch, the Anthropocene, from around 1945 to 1950, rather than the end of the 18th century as first proposed. From a strictly stratigraphic point of view, a million years hence, perhaps the sharpest marker in the rock record will be the sudden deposition of radionuclides across the Earth's surface as a result of nuclear explosions in 1945. This is known as the bomb spike. Although the nuclear age itself did not change the functioning of the Earth system, the layer of radionuclides laid down in 1945 does mark the dawn of the era of US global hegemony and the astounding period of material expansion of the post-war decades, that is, of capitalism's sublime success. We now understand what that success meant for the Earth system. James Savitsky puts it succinctly, by any unbiased and quantitative measure, humans have affected the surface of the Earth at a magnitude that ice ages have had on our planet, but over a much shorter period of time. The course of the Earth has been changed irrevocably. So 1945, or thereabouts, marks the turning point in the sweep of Earth's history, at which the geological evolution of the planet switched from one driven by the blind forces of nature to one influenced by a conscious, willing being, a new geological power. We're accustomed to the idea of humans as the agents that make history, and we use the term prehistory for the period from the emergence of early humans to the invention of writing. Now we have to concede what seemed impossible to contemplate: humans as agents changing the course of deep history, or rather, Earth's deep future. Although we're preoccupied with what the Anthropocene may mean for the future of humans, the present decades mark a transition in the Earth's biogeological history, because that now enters a new phase, because the Earth's history has now become entangled with human history, so that, in the words of Jan Zalasiewicz et al., the fate of one determines the fate of the other. The fate of one determines the fate of the other. In a few short decades, we have seen the entire history of the Earth, from its formation through to its eventual vaporization when the sun finally explodes, split into two halves. The first 4.5 billion years, in which Earth history was determined by blind natural forces alone, and the remaining 5 billion years, in which it will be influenced by a conscious power long after that power is spent. So we need to recognise, for the rest of what I'm going to say, the two essential claims of Earth system science, because failure to separate them has led to endless confusion. On the one hand, Earth system science tells us that humans have become so powerful that we rival the great forces of nature. On the other, the forces of nature have been roused from their Holocene slumber, becoming more dangerous and more uncontrollable. Humans have never been more potent, have never exercised more influence over the Earth. Yet we are now vulnerable to the power of nature in a way we have not known for at least 10,000 years, when the last great ice sheets retreated. The climate system is becoming more energetic, bringing more storms, wildfires, droughts and heat waves. So while technology allows us to divert rivers and harness the power of the atom, Gaia has been enraged, so to speak, and sends Hurricane Sandy, before which our powers appear puny. So, taken together, there is more power at work on Earth. A power struggle between humankind and the Earth is underway, but at a higher level than ever before. Only when we accept both facts, humans are more powerful, the Earth is manifesting more power, can we properly grasp the situation humans now confront. So, let me now suggest shifting more from the science to the social science and philosophy. Let me now suggest five implications of this new understanding, the return of anthropocentrism. The two essential claims of Earth system science, the extraordinary power of humans to disrupt the Earth system and the uncontrollable powers of nature unleashed in the Anthropocene, give rise to what I call the new anthropocentrism. I say a new anthropocentrism because, I'll suggest, humankind became a unified entity, an anthropos, for the first time only in the second half of the 20th century. And as such, it has become the central agent on a new kind of Earth. The new anthropocentrism diverges from the anthroposupremacism that brought us the ecological crisis. Yet it also runs counter to virtually all philosophical understandings of modern environmentalism and post-humanism. Attempts to counter anthropocentric stances by adopting a non-human-centred standpoint, that of nature or ecosystems or other creatures, or by spreading human agency around into ecosystems, For example, without regard to the human exception, these can only be stories the exceptional creature tells itself. The new anthropocentrism of the Anthropocene follows from the emergent understanding of the Earth system and humankind's role in it, and the case can be brought together as follows. First, we need to understand that instead of old ideas of nature and the environment, we are situated in the Earth system, that is, the planet, taken as a whole, in a constant state of flux, driven by interconnected cycles and forces from its core, out to the atmosphere and beyond to the moon, and powered by the flow of energy from the sun. Human activity participates in and modifies the myriad processes that constitute the Earth system. So powerful are our interventions that we have destabilized the functioning of the system itself, taking the Earth into a new geological epoch, or perhaps even an era. Some of the disruptions we've caused to Earth system processes are now unstoppable. Think of the acidification of the ocean, for instance. And the effects will persist for millennia or more. We've disturbed the Earth from its peaceful Holocene slumber, and it's too late to go back. We cannot wind back the geological clock. These facts place human beings inescapably at the centre of the future of Earth's geological evolution. They mean that human agency is now more potent than ever, even if we now understand that agency not as the autonomous capacity of free beings, foreseen or imagined by early modern philosophers like Kant, not as the autonomous capacity of free beings, but agency as a force always embedded in networks and processes. Our power in the Earth system gives humankind greater responsibility than we've ever possessed. Once humans separated from other creatures and we began deliberately to use our world-making powers to modify our environments, we assumed a kind of responsibility for nature. But now that responsibility has passed to the point, shifted to a new level, where the fate of humans and the fate of the Earth as a whole are intertwined. So, considering the three main ethical theories for those who study this thing, above our reason, our virtues, and our duties to one another, our unshakable responsibility for nature, for the Earth system, defines us as moral beings. In other words, our moral nature lies in the realm of necessity, not in the realm of freedom. And it's this amplified responsibility for the Earth that's at the heart of what I'm calling the new anthropocentrism. While it's human-centred, it's the opposite of the stance of exploitation and control embodied in previous anthropocentrisms. Rather than distributing human agency or watering it down by embedding it in something much larger than we are, our agency has grown, expanded, become more potent, and the obligation now is to embrace it, to own it, rather than to disavow it or exploit it. Like older forms, the new anthropocentrism of the Anthropocene accepts that humans are at the centre, but instead of assuming that the whole revolves around us, it sees humans as infusing the whole and influencing its functioning. Whereas the old form declares that humankind has God-given or self-assigned moral dominion over the Earth, the new form begins from the fact that humankind has in practice acquired enough power to change the Earth's course, and concludes that humans therefore have moral responsibility for it. The old form assumes that the Earth provides endless bounty for the benefit of humans. The new form believes that the Earth will not provide continuous bounty unless humans take care of it. Instead of concluding that humans are free to do whatever we want, the new anthropocentrism insists that humans are not free to do whatever we want, but must restrain ourselves and restrict what we do. Any defence of anthropocentrism naturally creates anxiety. Doesn't the elevation of humans to the status of the special creature inevitably bring hubris. In other words, if we admit anthropocentrism, we cannot avoid anthroposupremacism. But in truth, we have no choice other than to insist on a distinction between an arrogant anthropocentrism and a humble anthropocentrism. To be humble does not require that we deny our significance. Indeed, the greatest humility is available to the most significant. The Dalai Lama, for instance, is feted by Hollywood and pursued by world leaders. Yet he has far greater opportunity for humility than any one of his multitude of anonymous devotees. Turning to point two. At first sight, the new anthropocentrism might be misunderstood as close to eco-modernism. For eco-modernists, instead of being the final proof of the dangers of hubris, the Anthropocene is welcomed as a sign of humankind's destiny to control nature. For them, and they're centred around the US think tank known as the Breakthrough Institute, for them, the Anthropocene is not evidence of human short-sightedness or foolishness, nor of global capitalism's rapaciousness. The Anthropocene is an opportunity for humans finally to come into their own. Leading eco-modernist Earl Ellis urges us to see the Anthropocene not as a crisis, but as, quote, the beginning of a new geological epoch ripe with human-directed opportunity. And he speaks of the good Anthropocene. Humanity's transition to a higher level of planetary significance is, he says, an amazing opportunity. And, quote, we will be proud of the planet we create in the Anthropocene. And this vision has been condensed into an eco-modernist manifesto in which the signatories transcend the modest aim of a good Anthropocene to envisage a great Anthropocene. The new anthropocentrism is radically different to eco-modernism's anthroposupremacism. It's true that both understand humans as occupying a central place with a unique transformative role on Earth. Yet eco-modernism remains entrenched in the humanist tradition in which human spontaneity and creativity make the future, whatever future humans choose. The new understanding is anti-humanist because it recognizes the hard constraints on world-making imposed by a finite and untamable Earth. Whereas the eco-modernists see a humanized Earth as inevitable and desirable, for the new anthropocentrism, a humanized Earth understood as an Earth system disturbed by human activity is neither inevitable or desirable. In fact, a kind of humanized Earth, the kind of humanized Earth we now live on, is what we always had to fear, the product of the misuse of our creative powers. While eco-moderns see humans as essentially benign, the new anthropocentrism sees humans as highly ambivalent, capable of enormous creative renewal, but equally capable of catastrophic hubris and overreach. The new anthropocentrism views the whole not as ultimately benevolent, but as always suspended between good and evil, or rather, between sustaining us and destroying us. Unlike eco-modernism, it has no tacit faith that all will turn out well in the end. Indeed, the capricious and uncontainable power of nature always threatens to come roaring into action should we push it too hard, as we have. The absence of this sense of the countervailing power of nature, of the Earth system, which always has to be respected and feared, goes a long way towards explaining why eco-moderns can sugarcoat the Anthropocene with a layer of naive hopefulness. For them, the inborn dynamic of progress, with a capital P, means the negativity of ecological damage is sublated or assimilated into a positive force for change. The outcome is the product of a collaboration between a compliant but resilient nature and a creative species whose hegemony is ordained. If in theology man is the creation of God in his image and therefore always subject to a greater power, in the eco-modernists' anthropology, man is the creature of nature as its highest living form. And this nature is not a power that rules over man. The tables are turned and man rules over nature. Let me go to the third. Oh, how'd that go? 1, 2, 3, 1, 2. That should be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's a gremlin. The modern idea, so the end of nature. The modern idea of the environment as a set of resources available for endless exploitation is now exposed as a Holocene conception. But so is the ecological alternative to it. That is the idea of a passive nature now violated by humans. Both are being replaced by the conception of an inscrutable and unpredictable entity with a long history of capricious change and volatile mood swings. I'm anthropomorphizing, of course, but you can't do otherwise. You have to use metaphors to try to get a sense of what's going on. Earth system scientists use metaphors too, all the time, to try and capture it. Rough ones to capture this new idea. So they speak of the wakened giant, the ornery beast, of Gaia fighting back and seeking revenge, a world of angry summers and death spirals. This new conception of the Earth system is inconsistent with the understanding of a nature victimized and taken over by humans. The understanding captured in phrases from the books in the 1990s, for example, phrases like the end of nature, there's nothing but us, the earth's cry for rescue, and morphing more recently, in more recent times, into renderings like a humanized earth, the kind of nature we wish to have. Nature no longer exists apart from humanity, and it is our choice what happens here. Whether the mood is one of lament or triumph, mixed in with all of those kinds of statements from books and phrases of recent times, in all of these expressions, nature is our victim or our servant. Yet Earth system science now tells us that rather than dying, the death of nature, nature, as the Earth system, has actually come alive. Or perhaps a better metaphor, is waking from its slumber. It's true that wherever we look, we see human influence, a humanized earth, but at the same time we see stirring an angry, ornery, vengeful earth, to use the scientists' metaphors, one that is actually more detached from us than it has been for at least 10,000 years. Against the idea that we can have the nature we wish to have, as we go into the Anthropocene, we will have an earth that is further and further than the earth we might want. In other words, this range of views about the end of nature and a humanized earth, the eco-modernist vision of a humanized earth subject to our choices, these may have been consistent with a Holocene view, but they're now superseded by Earth system science. Holocene thinking has been supplanted by Anthropocene thinking, and this all follows from the claim that the Anthropocene is a recent rupture, whereas all of these other views about the death of nature and so on don't recognise that a rupture has occurred, but write as if there's a continuity, a continuous process of human colonisation going back thousands of years, albeit one that's been intensified in recent times. If on this new earth notions of mastery have to be discarded as delusions, the benign ideas of good stewardship and a loving Mother Earth are redundant too. Nature is no longer a victim, passive and fragile, suffering in silence. The sister who cries out to us, in Pope Francis's image. In the Anthropocene, it's no longer tenable to believe, in the words of the encyclical, that our common home is like a sister with whom we share our life and a beautiful mother who opens her arms to embrace us. In the calm and clement Holocene, to view the world as entrusted to men and women was a plausible working hypothesis, but no more. Now, when Mother Earth opens her arms, it's not to embrace us, more likely to crush us. Our goal can no longer be to save nature, but to save ourselves, from ourselves and from nature, knowing that every disturbance to the Earth system reduces our chances of doing so. Fourthly, grand narratives are dead, until now. Does the fact of human central agency in the Anthropocene imply a return to discredited grand narratives, or meta-narratives, as they're known? A meta-narrative may be said to have two elements: a universal truth above all other truths, and an end towards which the universal truth moves the world, which serves as a narrative's legitimizing function because it assumes that the end is a desirable one. The most kind of obvious ones are modernization, the inevitable march of modernization, or its more familiar form nowadays, progress. As the primary target of postmodernism, grand narratives that order and explain human experience are out of fashion. Reading laws into the unfolding human record seems to deprive humans of their autonomy and diversity. Those grand narratives of the past, modernization, progress, liberal capitalism, remember the end of history, Marxism, Hegelian flowering of spirit, and indeed all utopias on earth, these are grand narratives, buried worlds of difference between what was essentially a Eurocentric ideology. Their explicit or implicit teleology of universal and inevitable human progress could no longer be defended after the privileged place of the male European understanding of the world had been exposed. The view today is that humans make their own futures in 1,000 diverse, if culturally conditioned, ways, and there is no overarching story or direction to our collective existence on Earth. Yet, if the modern's grand narrative of universal humanity joined in a common project for human advancement failed, that doesn't mean there can never be a story that draws all humans together. Is not the Anthropocene the totalizing event par excellence, whose arrival provides a universal truth, a master narrative above all local narratives? Local worlds still matter, of course, but Earth system science tells us that we live on the Earth, which is more than a collection of many local worlds. The Earth is a dynamic, evolving total entity above and beyond the local, and increasingly deciding the fate of all locals. Bruno Latour tells us that to reset modernity, we must relocalize the global. Living in the Anthropocene, though, means we also must globalize the local. And when Donna Haraway says, knowledge is always situated, I reply, yes, situated in the Earth. The new narrative of the Anthropocene is still being written, and it's hard to see even a draft. But the conditions underlying it, I think, are becoming clear, and they are of a life lived and ordered under the shadow of the new geological epoch, one where the local is increasingly dominated by the global, where the events of political history are already showing the stamp of global environmental change, where relations between states increasingly centre on managing and adapting to a recalcitrant earth, where lives are more and more sensitive to natural events displaying a human handprint, and where our collective interest in preserving the planet's livability increasingly competes with our private interests. While the new narrative collects together all humans in its story, it diverges from all previous meta-narratives in what it promises, or rather in what it doesn't promise. Its universal truth is the new power struggle between humans and nature in the Anthropocene, yet it doesn't promise universal freedom and the fulfillment of human potential. It promises the reverse. There's no promise of a happy ending in the Anthropocene narrative. It's not a story we want to believe in, it's one we're compelled to accept. If the grand narratives of modernity lent legitimacy to the prevailing order, the accusation levelled at them, the arrival of the Anthropocene serves to delegitimise the prevailing order. If, as postmodern critics suggest, science is a legitimising narrative for the prevailing order, then the prevailing order now finds itself under siege from science. So the new narrative does not serve the powerful, but exposes their absolute failure. If the vision of mankind, if I can use that 19th century term, mankind in general was an illusion of 19th century Europe, there's no reason to believe that it must always remain a fantasy. If Enlightenment imaginings of liberal cosmopolitanism, with its principles of individual rights and universal truth, were legitimately accused of imperialism and absolutism, one can't accuse the judgments of Earth System Science of either. And while the globalisation project has been guilty of both imperialism and absolutism in spades, the enthusiasm of its victims, once drawn in to live under its imperial rule, tends to rob the criticism of its sting. And so we gaze into a future of a globalised world on an Anthropocene Earth, one that will increasingly rule over everyday life and consciousness wherever one dwells. Above all the diversity stand one global economy, one global culture, one total Earth. Earth history and human history have become entwined, so that the fate of one determines the fate of the other, a fate that not even the most privileged can escape. Let me finish then with a couple of comments on this last theme, nihilism and the meaning of human extinction. A handful of serious thinkers in the sciences and beyond are facing up to the implication of the scientific warnings and are turning their minds to the prospects of human extinction on an Earth rendered uninhabitable by our disruption of the Earth system. If you go down to Blackwell's bookshop, you can buy half a dozen of them, books developing and thinking about this theme. Now, it's commonplace to be reminded of humanity's tenuous place on an insignificant planet in a minor solar system adrift in the vastness of space. Nietzsche expressed it brutally some 150 years ago. He wrote, "In some remote corner of the Earth, poured out and glittering in innumerable solar systems, there once was a star on which clever animals invented knowledge. After nature had drawn a few breaths, the star grew cold and the clever animals had to die." And these evocations are ventured to shatter the self-importance that always threatens when humans acquire power, or believe they are God's chosen creatures. Whereas cosmologies once told stories of how humans give meaning to the cosmos, now cosmology has another meaning. It's the study of the physics of the universe. And it's used to remind us that human history barely registers on the scale of deep time, that the Earth is a pinprick in the vastness of the universe, and that we are of no consequence whatsoever. In response to the clamour to save the planet, there are those who echo Nietzsche's indifference towards the clever animal that had to die, blithely reminding us that while humans may extinguish themselves, the planet will live on. So John Gray, for instance, in Straw Dogs, captures this mood. Homo sapiens is only one of very many species and not obviously worth preserving. Later or sooner, it will become extinct. When it is gone, the Earth will recover. The Earth will forget mankind. In the same vein, James Lovelock, his conception of Gaia, has no reverence for life. Gaia is indifferent to human life, and Lovelock himself views the mass elimination of human beings with equanimity. It's a cold, functionalist understanding of life, the polar opposite of the pre-modern world, where, in one felicitous phrase, soul flooded the whole of existence. As soon as one reflects on the actual process of wiping humans from the planet, we see the essential cruelty of this kind of sentiment from Nietzsche, Gray, and Lovelock, and plenty of others. I actually hear it all the time. Any kind of commentary on blogs underneath an article about climate change or the Anthropocene, someone will start saying, "What the hell, when humans become extinct, it won't matter, the Earth will go on." I prefer to see the expression of indifference to human life as a kind of confected cynicism aimed at self-protection, so that these statements are better read not literally but as a kind of gambit aimed at turning exasperation into a more endurable apathy. In truth, if humans were wiped from Earth, the planet would not live on, not in any meaningful sense, because it's we who give the Earth meaning. Marking it out as the unique planet in the cosmos is not true, as a poster in the Paris Metro warned during COP21, that nature doesn't need humankind. Unless one truly believes that humans are no different to, say, chimpanzees, and that chimps are not obviously worth preserving, in Gray's expression. It's true, as Claude Lévi-Strauss once remarked, that the world began without man and will end without man. Yet we now cannot deny that it's the human that defines it. Homo sapiens appeared no more than 200,000 years ago and may disappear in the next centuries from the face of the Earth. Yet our species' direct influence will endure for hundreds of thousands of years at least, and leave an indelible mark. If in a million years' time an extraterrestrial civilization writes the history of the universe, the Earth will be known as the planet of the humans. Thanks very much.